Welcome to Authorial Intentions, a series of conversations about recently published or forthcoming books by faculty in Vanderbilt University's Divinity School and Graduate Department of Religion. I'm Chris Benda, theological librarian at Vanderbilt University's Divinity Library, and today's interview will be something of a departure since it won't be about a recently published book or with a Vanderbilt author. Instead, I'll be talking with Robert Alter, class of 1937, professor of Hebrew and comparative literature at the University of California, Berkeley, about scholarly trajectories, disciplinary identity, and translation. My thanks to Allison Schachter, Program Director of Jewish Studies, for arranging this interview, and to you, Professor Alter, for being willing to do it.
I'm happy to do it.
Wonderful. Many folks like me know you from your book, The Art of Biblical Narrative, and subsequent books on biblical poetry and the world of biblical literature, or from your translations of portions of the Hebrew Bible. Others will also know you for your work on modern Hebrew literature, and others for your work on the novel, and others for your work on something else. In other words, your scholarship has quite a range. So I wonder if you could talk a bit about your path from your first book on the picaresque novel to your recent translations of the Hebrew Bible.
Okay. As your listeners can make out from what you've said, I'm all over the place. I have a kind of wandering eye. That's why I had been an undergraduate English major at Columbia, and I thought, well, I'm going to do a PhD in comparative literature, so I'm not stuck just with one literature. Mm. And that has been something of my trajectory. So I trained in modern literatures at Harvard. My major literature was English, and the two minors were French and Hebrew, modern Hebrew. Mm. And since there was nobody, unfortunately, who did modern Hebrew on the Harvard faculty, I did that as a kind of autodidact. But that was all right. So I began. Now, I had done some, more than some, I'd done 4 years of biblical texts in Hebrew while I was an undergraduate, not at Columbia, where it was not offered, but up the block. Those of you who know Manhattan geography, about six blocks up Broadway from Columbia's Jewish Theological Seminary. And I had done work on the Bible there, and so I knew Biblical Hebrew well. And I was particularly fascinated by the narratives, which seemed to me stunning, but I couldn't figure out why they were stunning, because they from another point of view, they seemed so simple, terse, without any of the elaboration that we're familiar with from the novel. Mm. So for the first 15 years of my career, I focused on the novel. I published the little book on the picaresque novel you mentioned, which was my dissertation, and then a book on Fielding and a book on the self-reflexive tradition in the novel. And on the side, I was doing pieces on on modern Hebrew literature. And that's actually what brought me from the East Coast, where I'd lived entirely till then, to Berkeley. Mm. Because in the mid-60s, a Department of Comparative Literature was established at Berkeley. And Alan Renoir, the son of Jean Renoir, the famous film director, was the founding chair, and he had this vision of creating a far-reaching Department of Comparative Literature, which would have joint appointments with all the dark places of the university, like departments of Asian studies and Near Eastern studies and Spanish, and would bring the light of comparative literature to these departments. So they started looking for somebody in modern Hebrew literature. And at the time, this is no longer true, I was more or less the only one who could put together pretty literate sentences in English on Hebrew literature. And I had published these pieces, which came to the attention of the Berkeley people. They made me an offer I couldn't refuse. I crossed the continent, and I've never looked back. Now, being in comp lit at Berkeley offered me a freedom to range, which I didn't quite have when I was... My first job, I neglected to mention, was in the English department at Columbia. So after I had been at Berkeley about a decade, maybe a little less than a decade, I think, it all started when I gave three talks in an annual series at Stanford on modern Jewish writers. And the man who was then teaching Hebrew Bible at Stanford, Ted Good, Edward Good, said, well, while you're here, why don't you give a little informal talk on biblical narrative? So I said, okay, I guess I could put something together. So I put something together. And then a few things converged in the next year or so. First, I began to feel, well, maybe I could explain certain things about the greatness of biblical narrative. Then I was writing a three or four time a year column, which basically was an article on Jewish life and letters for Commentary, which then was a very different magazine. You know, it's become very hardline neoconservative in the last couple of decades. And so I was always searching for topics. And so at one point, I called up the man with whom I was working, who's a friend, Neil Cazador. I said, how would you guys like an article on the need for a literary perspective on the Bible? And I thought he would say no, because it's always been a journal focused on contemporary issues. And he said, why not? So I wrote this article. I was pretty young at the time. So it was kind of very feisty and provocative and said things like biblical scholars waste all their time hunting down purported Akkadian loanwords when they don't know how to read a story. And here is how to read a story, and I try to show. So I thought this was going to be a one-off. But there was an outpouring of letters, both letters to the editor and letters to me personally. So I thought, well, people seem interested in this. I have a few more ideas about the biblical narrative. I'll write another article. Pretty soon, it was four articles, not all of them for Commentary. I think one was in Critical Inquiry, actually. And so I was on my way to writing a book on biblical narrative. And my advice to anybody who gets involved in any way in the Bible is that it's a slippery slope. Because I was saying, first the article was going to be a one-time thing. Then I said, well, I'm not really a Bible scholar. I may know something about the Bible, but so I'll write this book and get it off my chest, and that's it. So the book came out 1981, and it's been in continuous print, actually, for 36 years now. That's a long time. I once did a calculation. You know, it obviously sells modestly, but it continues to sell. So if you say like 3,000 or so copies a year, so that's over 100,000 copies. It's a slow motion bestseller. Then there was a very good critical response to the narrative book. So I thought, well, why not a book on poetry, on biblical poetry? So, but by that time, I had slid down the slope, and I did not, I should stress, abandon my interest in or passion for modern literature, mm-hmm. and continue to write books on the subject.
Mm-hmm. And I want to talk a little bit later in a bit more detail about translation,
sure.
And the Hebrew Bible. But I wanted to ask a question about where you think your scholarship fits disciplinarily. I mean, you've done work in literary studies, comparative literature, biblical studies, Jewish studies. So do you identify with any particular area more than any others? Or how would you characterize your disciplinary identity?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think, basically, a literary person.
Mm-hmm.
So, when I began writing about the Bible, I thought, hey, what I can do is what the people who are trained at Harvard, Yale, Hopkins, etc., in biblical studies can't do, which is I will apply my understanding of narrative and then afterward of poetry as a literary scholar to the Bible. And in part, that's what I did. But I also have to say that there was a touch of disciplinary arrogance in that. That is, there's an assumption, okay, I understand what narrative is all about as a literary scholar, and I will explain it to the biblical scholars and to people who read the Bible. What's wrong with that conception is that it assumes that you can take a set of concepts or a methodology or a theory of literature from literary studies and just slap it down on the Bible, which some people have done, as you probably know. What I discovered was that in certain ways, scrutinizing the biblical literary texts was teaching me something about literature, especially with a narrative, maybe, because since the biblical narrative is so pared down, so quintessentially compact, in a way, the underlying dynamics of narrative as such are more visible there than they are when you read Dickens, say.
Mm-hmm.
So, even there, I was looking through literary eyes. So, I would say that my primary disciplinary identification has been as a literary scholar. Now, in terms of the perception of others, well, I think that people, there is a fair number of people in departments of English or comparative literature who have read my things on the Bible, either out of general curiosity or because they get assigned from time to time that inevitable course in departments of English, the Bible as literature. So they read my biblical narrative book and the biblical poetry book, and they understand that they're written by a literary scholar. It's maybe a little more complicated in the case of biblical scholars. I think that there are some that are interested in my work and take it seriously, and they figure, well, this isn't exactly what we were trained to do, but it's something of interest and it's worth reading. I was surprised a year or two after The Art of Biblical Narrative appeared, I was invited to the annual meeting of the Society for Biblical Literature to speak in a plenary session about the book on biblical narrative. You know, I didn't think that biblical scholars would go that far. However, to be perfectly candid, I'm sure there are many biblical scholars who figure, well, maybe the stuff Alter does interests some people, but it's really not what we do, and we don't consider it biblical scholarship. I mean, we are interested in issues such as how we refine the documentary hypothesis, or whether we replace it, as some German scholars have been trying to do, with another hypothesis, and about the evolution of biblical Hebrew and issues of establishing the text, and so on. You're familiar with the field, so you know. Now, let me add this. This may not be generally perceived by this group of scholars that I'm talking about. I am actually very interested in philology. And of course, philology is really inseparable from literary scholarship, as well as from biblical scholarship. Like, to my mind, the greatest work of literary criticism written in the 20th century was Erich Auerbach's Mimesis. And what was his field? Romance philology. So I'm really keen on philology. And especially after I got into translating, I've been doing a lot of it. My gripe is that biblical scholars, although they announce fervently that they're philologists, don't do it right. And I'll tell you what, I could give you examples, maybe I won't. They don't do it right for the following reason. When it comes to understanding the meanings of biblical Hebrew, they tend to think in terms of lexical values. And that is only one component of meaning. That is, meaning has to do with linguistic register. It has to do with associative nuances of words, and so forth. That's one gripe. Second gripe has to do with the pitfall of what you call in French faux amis, false friends. That is, biblical philologists are very keen on unearthing the meanings of words by detecting cognates in other Semitic languages. And sometimes it's useful, especially when you're totally stuck and here's a hapax legomena word that appears only once. Ah, there's something in Akkadian, right? But the problem is that most proposed cognates, even if the word looks similar, are false friends. I'll give you an example from French. If you were a biblical scholar trying a biblical-like scholar in the 29th century trying to reconstruct 21st century English, and you came across this peculiar word to assist, and you knew 21st century French pretty well, and you know that assister in French means to attend, like to attend a meeting. So that's what it must mean in English, but of course it doesn't. I will just add this in terms of my rejoinder to biblical philology, that one of the keys to understanding the meaning of words is the literary context in which they appear. I will, in the address I'm going to give this evening at Vanderbilt on translating the Bible, I will give some examples. Mm-hmm.
Okay, great. We can actually turn to the translation, and hopefully we're not going to step over too much what you're going to be talking about later this evening, but the Bible, both the Hebrew Bible, and the combination with the Christian New Testament has famously been translated by both individuals and committees, and surely by groups in between those two extremes.
Right.
Perhaps even many translations by individuals are really collaborations in one form or another. And translations projects have been undertaken for many reasons and aimed at varying audiences. So I wonder if you could talk a bit about some of the reasons you have taken up translation of the Hebrew Bible. You've already talked a little bit about that in terms of philology. So why go into this project of translating the Hebrew Bible? Who are you? Who do you see as your audience for these translations? And what are the benefits of being an individual doing these translations versus a committee? I mean, are there any things that you're losing out by not being part of a committee and doing a translation?
Okay, that's a really good question. Well, I'll begin with an anecdotal explanation. I don't think I'm going to use this anecdote this evening.
Okay.
So I never intended to become a biblical scholar, I never intended to be a translator of the Bible.
Mm.
Here's what happened. Back in the early 90s, I was spending a visiting year at Princeton. And this very amiable man, who Steve Foreman, who's an editor at W.W. Norton, got in touch with me and said, I'm going to be down in Princeton next week, and I would like to meet you. So he came to my office, and he said, we would love you to do a Norton critical edition. Now, perhaps I should explain for your listeners,
sure.
But I mean, we teachers know
right.
that. It's a lovely series that Norton has had for decades, where a classical text, let's say Moby Dick, is presented for students with usually a helpful introduction, occasional footnotes, and in the back of the book, all kinds of ancillary material, like in the case of Moby Dick, which I've taught from the Norton Critical Edition, it would be whaling books that Melville consulted, correspondence between Melville and his contemporaries, early reviews of the book, modern critical essays. So that's a Norton Critical Edition. So Steve Foreman from Norton said, we would love you to do this, either something from Kafka, because I just published a book then that in part dealt with Kafka, or something from the Bible. So I said, gee, it would be possible to make a really neat Norton Critical Edition out of the Book of Genesis, because there's a lot of very good ancillary material now available which you could put in the back of the book. But the problem is, and I'm an imprudent person, I said something very imprudent. I said, there's something really wrong with all the existing English translations. So if I were to do this, I would have to do my own translation. At that point, Steve Foreman began a conversation with my literary agent, and in the end, we resolved to do a translation of Genesis, which was not a Norton Critical Edition. And also, one other thing that I fell into, I originally thought I would just do translator's notes. But halfway through the first chapter of Genesis, I said, there's so many great things to talk about. So I ended up producing a commentary. And so I've been a commentator ever since. Okay. Now, my motivation for doing this, and I will go into this in more detail in my lecture here, is that since I had been reading the Bible in Hebrew since late adolescence, let's say, the Hebrew has always spoken to me very profoundly. Mm. It's the beauty of its literary fashioning, its rhythms, and so forth. And I didn't feel that any of the existing translations paid much attention to all that. The closest is the King James Version, but the King James Version doesn't invariably pay attention, and the Hebrew of the King James corporations, as they were called, those subcommittees, was sometimes a little faulty or even very faulty. And then, of course, the language is archaic. So I thought maybe it would be interesting to try to do this. Mm. Now, I thought, again, it would be Genesis and that's all. I also, at least sometimes, to be perfectly honest, thought it was a quixotic enterprise. Because the structure of ancient Hebrew and the structure of modern English and the range of semantic values of their vocabularies, all this is so different that to try to convey the power and the subtlety of the Hebrew literary style in English would produce something that would look silly. Mm. And that's when I did the first chapter. I thought, that probably looks silly.
I better explain this.
Anyway, but I went on and I thought, well, maybe it's not so bad, but I don't know. You know, perhaps everybody will hate it, and I'll decide that I hate it too. But it turned out to be, it's not perfect, but a rather better approximation of what I had in mind than I thought it would be. And it was very enthusiastically received. So then I did my other favorite stretch of narrative in the Hebrew Bible, which is the David story. Mm. And from there I tumbled on to other things. And now I'm pretty, the end is really in sight. That is, I now have a complete draft of the whole Hebrew Bible.
Wow.
My, as we speak, my faithful transcriber, because I write by hand. It's just, I like to write my hand. I type very well, I want you to know. I want to assure your listeners I type very well. It was the most important thing I learned in high school was speed, touch typing.
Right.
So even as we speak, he is transcribing Chronicles, which in the Hebrew canon is the last book in order. And maybe in about 3 months, I'll send it off to Norton, and they plan to bring it out in the fall of 2018.
So this is going to be the whole thing?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
The whole thing.
Wow.
In either two or three rather overweight volumes.
Because some of the existing ones that have come out
are pretty
are quite,
big.
Quite
right,
big,
right,
yeah. Right. Wow. So who do you, when you're writing these, are you imagining a particular group of people? I asked you a multi-part question,
right,
which is unfair.
Right, I neglected that. No, that's... Now, I don't think I had a very clear idea of what audience I was addressing when I began the translation. If you pushed me to the wall, I would say, well, I really want to do this for people who love literature. This goes back to your question about my disciplinary affiliation. Somebody who loves the beauty of Flaubert's sentences or Joyce's cadences will maybe be able to read the Bible and say, hey, there's something just as great there.
Mm-hmm.
As it turned out, the audience has been more variegated than I had imagined it would be. That is, it's true that literary people like my translation a lot. And I know, say, in humanities courses or great books courses, where one of the tried and true items of the course is always Genesis, that very often, and Genesis, my Genesis is available in a paperback, a freestanding paperback. Very often, your professor of English or comparative literature will opt for signing my Genesis, but if, you know, for the reasons, which is fine because I get a little royalties from it. This is something that not all your listeners may be aware of. Before the internet, you would, from time to time, if you published in places other than obscure academic journals, and I generally published in journals of more general interest, you would get a letter, you know, a nice letter with a U.S. stamp on it. With email, anybody who wants to can just go to the comparative literature site at the University of California, Berkeley, get my address, and write me. So the volume of reader response is much bigger. Most of it, I've gotten one or two almost amusingly angry responses. My favorite one, Professor. You got to watch it when it starts that way.
Was it all in all caps? No, not that bad.
Professor, I am appalled at your arrogance in translating the Bible. There is only one guide to translating the Bible, and that is Jesus Christ our Lord. So, I couldn't claim any inside line there. But most of the responses I've gotten are enthusiastic ones, and they come from a surprising range of readers. I mean, I got one from an Episcopalian nun who said that my translation of Psalms had changed her spiritual practice, which is not what I had in mind. I've gotten messages from Presbyterian organists, from Methodist ministers, from modern Orthodox Jews. So I do have a sense that, well, I didn't have these kinds of groups clearly in mind, that it does seem to be speaking, the translation, to people in a wide range of groups.
Mm-hmm. Now, biblical translation isn't the only translation you've done. Recently, you edited a volume of poetry by Yehuda Amichai, which features some of your translations. So how did you get involved in this project? And I also wanted to ask you about your relationship to Hebrew. as a language. I mean, you've talked about the beauty that you wanted people to appreciate. I mean, it seems that the language of Hebrew is more than just a scholarly language for
right,
you.
Right, right, definitely.
So I wanted, could you talk a little bit about both of those?
Okay, I'll begin with the Hebrew. That's a really interesting question. Well, by the time I was 16, I mentioned having studied biblical Hebrew as a college student. But by the time I was 16, I was a fairly fluent speaker of modern Hebrew. I'd gone to Hebrew summer camps, which don't really exist in quite the same way. In those years, they were fanatically Hebrew. Everything was done in Hebrew. Mm. You know, the counselors spoke Hebrew to the kids, and so on and so forth. And probably my spoken Hebrew at first was a little incorrect. I think it's quite correct now. And then when I began college, I said to myself, I really want to master Hebrew. So I began reading long novels in Hebrew and looking up every word I didn't know. I think there's something you can only do when you're about 18 or 19 years old. The brain doesn't work the same way. Because I tried it later with other languages. And after a year and a half, I wasn't finding words I didn't know. So I had become totally literate in the language and totally fluent. So I would say I have a near native command of Hebrew, and a very good command of literary Hebrew. I mean, you know, maybe there is Hebrew slang that I don't use, and some that I don't know. But you know, that's minor. So I have, I would say, a kind of love of the language. I love its sounds, the nuances of words that are peculiar to it, and so forth. I enjoy speaking the language, and when I go to Israel, and this is despite all the appalling and ominous political problems in Hebrew, in Israel. We now seem to have our own set that look just as bad. I always feel very good when I arrive in Israel, and it's partly a cultural thing. That is, I've come back to the country where they speak my
language.
Now, I also love English. You know, it's my native language. I've grown up reading poets and novelists and so forth who write in gorgeous ways, from Dickens to Nabokov. And these are all people I've written on. So I would say that translating, to use an erotic metaphor, is a neat way to conduct a love affair with two languages at the same time, with Hebrew and with English. Now, that was part of your question, but
the Yehuda Amichai.
Oh, Amichai, translated. Right. Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. So I should say parenthetically that that Amichai and I became friends in 1966 when he was spending the year in New York, and we remained very good friends until his death. He and his wife stayed at our home in Berkeley on various visits. I remember he happened to be staying with us when Sadat flew to Tel Aviv for that historic meeting, and Yehuda and I got up at 5 o'clock in the morning to watch it live.
Wow.
So He is, I like a lot of modern Hebrew poetry, and also I've written more actually on prose fiction in Hebrew, and I think that there's some really exciting writers. Some of the best writers around happen to be producing their work in Hebrew. So I sometimes say that if the Israeli political system were in as good shape as the literature, things would be fine. So, you know, there are writers like David Grossman, A.B. Yehoshua, Amos Oz, I think all are quite wonderful in different ways. And there are many good poets. And these, of course, are writers whom I've taught at Berkeley over the years. But I think that certainly the greatest Hebrew poet of the second half of the 20th century is Yehuda Amichai. And I would frankly rate him with the great poets in any language in this period. That is, I would put him alongside Rilke and Wallace Stevens and Yeats and so forth. So the idea for the book actually was not my own. That is, I should say this, Amichai has been translated by many different people. Some of the translations are really good. For a whole bunch, for example, done by my Berkeley friend. She's not my colleague at the university, but my Berkeley friend, Chana Bloch. And then in collaboration by Chana Bloch and my colleague, Chana Kronfeld. Some of the other translations leave something or much to be desired, and some of them have embarrassing errors in understanding the Hebrew. So Jonathan Galassi, who's the editor-in-chief at Farshat Jeru, approached me and asked if I would put together a volume of a large volume of Amichai's poetry. I think it's over 500 pages. Using existing translations, and where that wasn't possible, doing my own. So I immediately agreed. It wasn't a big financial consideration, but it was a labor of love, because I loved the man and I loved the poetry. And I ended up, somewhat to my surprise, doing well over 100 poems myself. That is, some of them, poems that had never been translated, and I thought some of them were quite wonderful. I'm not sure why they were never translated. And some because I had problems with the existing translation. Even there were a number of instances where there were three different translations, there's one, for example, it's one of his great topics, which is the breakup of a love affair and the pain of the breakup of a love affair. So in this instance, there was one line that everybody totally misconstrued. Wow. And my fixed policy was that if there was even one offensive or offending word, I would not begin the business of negotiating with translators to revise it. I would do my own from scratch. Now, shall I explain to you the word?
Please, okay. Do, yes.
Okay, there is a Hebrew word, chol, which means two different unrelated things, two homonyms. One of its meanings is profane or secular, and the other is sand.
Hmm.
Now, in there's a line in this poem which begins with the male lover saying farewell to the woman he loved. He said, the line in the three existing translations reads something like this, and all came through our word, and all of sand.
Hmm.
And I suppose that they thought that it's maybe like sand dribbling away or falling through an hourglass
yeah.
something mm-hmm. like that. But in fact, that's not what it means. There is a blessing, you know, Orthodox Jews say blessings over everything. So there's a blessing you say, like when you drink a glass of schnapps, and it goes, blessed are you, Lord of the world, and so forth. And then that all has come about through his word. Orthodox Jews refer to this blessing as Shahakol, which means that all.
Mm.
So what the line of poetry is saying, alas, you have to annotate it, and I kind of explained it in the introduction to my book. What it means is everything came about through our word, and everything, a profane everything.
Mm.
In other words, this was not the shahakol, the everything of the sacred, but it's so we were like gods,
mm.
and everything we said seemed to come about when there was this passionate harmony between us. So that's so beautiful, and it's totally missed when you stick in sand.
Wow. So do you see yourself doing more translations of modern Hebrew literature or poetry, or was this just because of your relationship with Amichai?
Oh, it's conceivable. I mean, as you can see from my account of my career, it took a couple of surprising turns by accident.
Right.
So I'm not closing off future possibilities. And there are all kinds of things that I think of doing, and I may not end up doing. The thought has occurred to me, for example, now we go to a very different period. In 11th century Granada, there was a Jew named Shmuel Hanagid, I mean Shmuel the Prince, Samuel the Prince, who ended up through a very odd constellation of politics in the city-state of Granada, becoming the vizier of Granada.
Hmm.
Not the king, but the second. I think partly he was chosen because as a Jew he had no claim to displace the monarch or succeed him.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he was a very able guy. Obviously, he was politically able. He also, as vizier, was general of the army of Granada and went out on military campaigns every summer, which is strange. And he wrote battle poems.
Wow.
In Hebrew. He also wrote wonderful drinking poems, which was one of the genres of medieval Arabic and Hebrew poetry, and also haunting, philosophic, reflective poems.
Mm.
So this is one of the extraordinary lives of the Middle Ages, and it occurred to me that it might be really interesting to try to write a biography of Hanagid, which would obviously include translations of a lot mm-hmm. of the poems. But we'll see. I'm not sure if I'll get to that or not.
Well, I wanted to ask one final question before we close, and this is also a translation-related question. If one looks at the article about you on the Poetry Foundation's website...
Oh, I've never seen that.
One sees that they've designated you the author of one of the Psalms. It says, Psalms 23 by Robert Alter. And I'm juxtaposing this with a comment that you made in a 2013 lecture, where you said, quote, translation is really a very extreme form of close reading.
Oh, right.
So writing and reading, creating and construing, is there for you any sense of the authorial in the translations that you do?
Not really. To be honest, it's more like being a very skilled ventriloquist. That is, if you take this wonderful Hebrew poem written surely more than 2.5 millennia ago, the 23rd Psalm, and you imagine, well, how would this great Hebrew poet make it sound if he were writing in an English that could be understood by English readers in the 21st century? So you do this translingual ventriloquistic act. so that's how I see it. But the maybe I'll pick up the close reading part. My translation, 23rd Psalm, at two or three points, and this has to do with philology too, is rather different from the establishment, even the 20th century ones that tend to be under the sway of the King James Version. So, two instances.
Sure.
Thou anointest my head with oil. Well, there is one word in biblical Hebrew for one verb for anointing, and that's the verb mashach, from which we get Mashiach, Messiah. And it's used in two contexts. One is priestly, that is the high priest is anointed with oil, and the other is political, that is in the biblical world, it's not the crown, or there is a crown, it's not the crowning, but the putting oil on the head that confirms the person in kingship. And that's not the word that's used here. The verb that's used is a verb that is associated with rich substance, with... well, maybe it does have some association with oil, but it has no sacerdotal or regal association at all. Rubbing the body and the head with good olive oil was part of the good sensual life in the ancient Mediterranean, not only for the Hebrews, but for the Greeks. You can see this in Homer. So it's a very this-worldly term. At my first stab, sometimes you make bad mistakes, I translate this, you pleasured my head with oil.
Mm.
And my wife, who is very discreet, said, no, no, no.
It takes it an entirely interesting direction.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think I settled for moistened.
Mm.
So that puts a different spin on mm-hmm. it. You see. And then at the end of the psalm, and I shall dwell in the house of the Lord forever.
Mm-hmm.
Well, forever suggests that the house of the Lord is up there.
Hmm.
I mean, it really is an intimation of the afterlife, which is not part of the worldview of the psalmist or of any of the biblical writers, with the possible exception of Daniel.
Hmm.
The literal sense of the Hebrew is for the length of days.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I translated it, sometimes I don't remember my own translation, I remember the Hebrew much better. I shall dwell in the house of the Lord for very long days.
Mm.
And the difference is this: the happiest place to be is in the temple in Jerusalem, because there you feel a closeness to God. So that's my aspiration, to get to Jerusalem. I have felt God's protection, his laying out a table for me before my enemies, and moistening my head with oil, and now I will complete the satisfaction in this life here and now by dwelling in the house of the Lord for a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
So there's both, I would say, a certain pleasure in detective work, in figuring out what these phrases mean in nuance, and then those meanings really lead to a certain shift in the world picture that emerges from the biblical text, and that's a satisfying thing to do.
Hmm. Thank you again very much for doing this interview, and best wishes in your talk this evening.
Okay.
Again, I've been talking with Robert Alter, class of 1937, professor of Hebrew and comparative literature at the University of California, Berkeley. If you have any comments about this conversation, just browse to the homepage of the Vanderbilt Divinity Library and click on the Ask a Librarian link on that page. We look forward to hearing from you, and thanks for listening.